visible on his track. They had followed him. He could hear them behind him, not very far behind. They were unshod, and their panting breathing was louder than their footfalls. He would have laughed if he had had time. He knew at last what it was like to be the hunted instead of the hunter, the quarry instead of the leader of the chase. It was to be alone, and to be free. He swerved to the right and dodged, stooping across a high parapeted bridge, slipped into a side street, around a corner, back to the riverside and along it for a way, across another bridge. His shoes were loud on the cobblestones, the only sound in all the city. He paused at the bridge abutment to unlace them, but the strings were knotted and the hunt had not lost him. The lantern glittered a second across the river. The soft, heavy, running feet came on. He could not get away from them. He could only outrun them. Keep going, keep ahead, and get them away from the dusty room, far away. They had stripped his coat off him, along with his dagger, and he was in shirt sleeves, light and hot, his head swimming, and the pain in the back of his skull pointing and pointing with each stride, and he ran and he ran. The bag hindered him. He flung it down suddenly, a loose gold piece flying out and striking the stones with a clear ring. "Here's your monster," he yelled, his voice hoarse and gasping. He ran on. And all at once, the street ended. No cross streets, no stars before him. A dead end. Without pausing, he turned back and ran at his pursuers. The lantern swung wild in his eyes, and he yelled defiance as he came at them. There was a lantern swinging back and forth before him, a faint spot of light in a great moving grayness. He watched it for a long time. It grew fainter, and at last a shadow passed before it, and when the shadow went on, the light was gone. He grieved for it a little. Or perhaps he was grieving for himself, because he knew he must wake up now. The lantern, dead, still swung against the mast to which it was fixed. All around the sea brightened with the coming sun. A drum beat. Oars creaked heavily, regularly. The wood of the ship cried and creaked in 100 little voices. A man up in the prow called something to the sailors behind him. The men chained with Arran in the afterhold were all silent. Each wore an iron band around his waist and manacles on his wrists, and both these bonds were linked by a short, heavy chain to the bonds of the next man. The belt of iron was also chained to a bolt in the deck, so that the man could sit or crouch, but could not stand. They were too close together to lie down, jammed together in the small cargo hold. Arran was in the forward port corner. If he lifted his head high, his eyes were on a level with the deck between hold and rail, a couple of feet wide. He did not remember much of last night past the chase and the dead-end street. He had fought and been knocked down and trussed up and carried somewhere. A man with a strange, whispering voice had spoken. There had been a place, like a smithy, a forge fire, leaping red. He could not recall it. He knew, though, that this was a slave ship, and that he had been taken to be sold. It did not mean much to him. He was too thirsty. His body ached and his head hurt. When the sun rose, the light sent lances of pain into his eyes. Along in mid-morning, they were given a quarter loaf of bread each and a long drink from a leather flask, held to their lips by a man with a sharp, hard face. His neck was clasped by a broad, gold-studded leather band like a dog's collar, and when Arran heard him speak, he recognized the weak, strange, whistling voice. Drink and food eased his bodily wretchedness for a while and cleared his head. He looked for the first time at the faces of his fellow slaves, three in his row and four close behind. Some sat with their heads on their raised knees. One was slumped over, sick or drugged. The one next to Aaron was a fellow of 20 or so with a broad, flat face. "Where are they taking us?" Aaron said to him. The fellow looked at him. Their faces were not a foot apart, and grinned, shrugging, and Aaron thought he meant he did not know. But then he jerked his manacled arms as if to gesture and opened his still grinning mouth wide to show, where the tongue should be, only a black root. "It'll be Shaul," said one behind Aaron, and another, "or the market at Amron." And then the man with the collar, who seemed to be everywhere on the ship, was bending above the hold, hissing, "Be still if you don't want to be shark bait." And all of them were still. Aaron tried to imagine these places. Shaul, the market of Amron. They sold slaves there. They stood them out in front of the buyers, no doubt, like oxen or rams for sale in Barilla Marketplace. He would stand there, wearing chains. Somebody would buy him and lead him home, and they would give him an order, and he would refuse to obey. Or obey and try to escape. And he would be killed, one way or the other. It was not that his soul rebelled at the thought of slavery. He was much too sick and bewildered for that. It was simply that he knew he could not do it. That within a week or two, he would die or be killed. Though he saw and accepted this as a fact, it frightened him, so that he stopped trying to think ahead. He stared down at the foul, black planking of the hold between his feet and felt the heat of the sun on his naked shoulders and felt the thirst drying out his mouth and narrowing his throat again. The sun sank. Night came on clear and cold. The sharp stars came out. The drum beat like a slow heart, keeping the oar stroke, for there was no breath of wind. Now the cold became the greatest misery. Aaron's back gained a little warmth from the cramped legs of the man behind him, and his left side from the mute beside him, who sat hunched up, humming a grunting rhythm all on one note.